Hi, friends. It's me, Abby Green. I'm so proud to announce my podcast, Sex, Politics, and Bacon. You are going to love it. You'll hear all about my outrageous Abby stories, from running with presidents and prime ministers or living in rural villages, or about busting drug dealers in New York City or fighting for those incarcerated in Alaska. You'll get to hear from all the crazy characters I've met throughout my adventures. Doctors changing the way we think about vaginas, Olympic martial artists, brilliant lawyers, wonderful criminals, political candidates, and yes, even fire eaters. I've got three amazing co-hosts, which I gathered from the land of misfit toys, and will bring you laughs, perspective, comfort, and hope. If you're feeling overwhelmed and like you can't catch your breath, subscribe to Sex, Politics, and Bacon. Find comfort in caring friends, good food, and really, really funny people. I guarantee you will laugh your ass off. I've created some amazing content and I can't wait to share it with you. So subscribe to Sex, Politics, and Bacon. Hi, and welcome to Sex, Politics, and Bacon. I'm your host, Abby Green. This week, Duncan and I are floored by the brilliant, funny, and quite talented attorney, John Nwosu. And I finally get to introduce the audience to my good friend of 11 years, Mac. He has been behind bars for 32 years and will soon know freedom. So join us as we talk sex, politics, and bacon. How are we doing?
Well, I can tell you what day it is. It is Wednesday, my dude.
It is Wednesday, my dudes.
They had different standards for what could pass as children's, like,
oh yeah,
TV.
That was a Roald Dahl book. I really liked Roald Dahl books.
Yeah, big time. Big time fan.
Mm-hmm. I tried to check, you know, look at some of them to start reading to Henry, even if it was just little parts of a story, because I thought they were so well written. And then I realized by sitting at the library pre-COVID, you know, when you go to the library, that like, 3 out of the 4 like mention child abuse on the first page of the book. And I was like, I do not remember it being this dark.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It
like,
but it is.
It is. Well, the like the
that's
witches.
What the kid has to overcome.
Yeah.
All kids' movies, I would say, have that dead mom, overcoming strife.
Like, yes.
Horrible shit.
Mm-hmm. Especially Disney. Have you
Especially
even
Especially like, Disney.
Yes. Really. It's like they're always missing a mom or a dad, or they die or whatever.
Both of them.
Yeah. I'm like,
were you having a good day? Were you enjoying yourself? Well, go watch Up. And now you're depressed.
It's a perfect woodland scene and little birds and singing, oh my God, it's a fire and mom and dad are dead. It's a fire. And here is more singing. Now it's all singing.
Oh my God. That's Disney in a nutshell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Perfectly described it.
Come here. That's why I really highly recommend, if you can get your hands on any Studio Ghibli Miyazaki films like My Neighbor Totoro, I would say it would be the Japanese equivalent of Disney.
What is it called? Yeah.
Studio Ghibli.
Studio Ghibli.
Or Ghibli. G-H-I-B-L-I. My Neighbor Totoro, Spirited Away.
Kinky's Delivery Service.
Yes. All of these beautiful stories that don't have anything to do with dead parents.
Mm.
And a lot of times they are female leads that are, you know, coming of age and not just looking for a man. They're finding out about themselves. And there's like really subtle, those movies super speak to me. So if you can get your hands on that shit.
Absolutely marks of art. Like 100%. They're time-honored classics. They are gorgeous, well-animated, well-written. Everything about them is top.
Howl's Moving Castle.
How could we forget Howl's Moving Castle?
We forget? So beautiful. All of them. It's so great.
Of course, I feel like,
no idea.
Turn it on and be like, oh, it's one of those Japanese cartoons. Fuck them.
Maybe, have you heard of Ponyo? Because I feel like that might have... Some of them, like The Secret Life of Arrietty, That one, I think, had like English dubs and was released by Disney. Some of the Ghibli stuff was like Disney contracted to do like the English voices, I want to say, maybe.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I know nothing about that world.
But I was really upset to have never known about it until my adult life. And I was like, it was one of, Totoro was the like one of the first movies I showed Willem.
Really?
Yeah.
I need to show my kids, honestly.
It's just so sweet. And
I like that you said, like, the, you know, a lot of them are girls coming of age and they don't need to find a man, like they're finding themselves.
And the woman don't need no man.
Mm-mm.
But it's not even like framed in that way, because a lot of the movies take place way back in the day in Japan. I think, you know, he's waxing nostalgic of his own childhood, or even that of, you know, his grandparents' childhood. Like,
oh wow.
So it's kind of a glimpse into old world Japan, which is, I don't know, in my opinion, like, I've romanticized it.
Yay! I'm John. Well, Abby, first of all, let me go back to how I get this from. Abby has been harassing me for the past 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Is it? I'm like, I need to get on this postcard. I'm like, okay, what am I getting on the postcard? What are we talking about? Like, everything and everything. So, and I told my wife today, because I put it on the calendar, and she was like, okay, what is the topic? I'm like, she said, bring a beer. I'm like, okay, have fun. All right. Well, me and Abby, we both went to Northeastern School of Law in Boston. That's where we met. And I think I left Northeastern as soon as I finished in 2009 and headed to Texas. What do you want to know? Why don't you ask me a question?
What area of law do you practice?
Oh, what area? Well, right now I started off doing criminal defense, which I really love, and I still do love. I do mainly criminal, well, I started off doing criminal defense, family law, immigration. And when I say immigration, I mean removal defense, people in removal proceedings. And did that for a number of years. And now I'm trying to concentrate on just immigration and family law. I'm kind of going off criminal defense. It's not because I really, really love it, and that is the problem, but it brings me the least amount of money. The money is not it's important because I have two kids, but I find myself always trying to fight the state, and I end up spending tons, you know, enormous amount of time on a case than I should. And then I bring it home, complain about it, because mostly we are in Texas, here in Mississippi. I don't know how the system is in Mississippi. Yep. Dallas is not that bad, but we have a lot of these outlying counties, you know, outside of Dallas, where, you know, the simplest thing as possession of marijuana, you know, the only way to really get the state to listen to you is to take this case to trial. And, you know, it's most of the time as in criminal defense practice, Texas as a whole state does not have a public defender program, you know, indigent defense. Anyway. Yes, I know, right? That was the first shocker to me. So it's county by county. So you can imagine, Travis, you know, the big counties have some sort of kind of quasi, you know, indigent defense program. Dallas do, but they cover about maybe 10%. I started up there, you know, I worked for free there when I was, because I didn't know anyone. So most of the work goes to private, you know, attorneys on what is called an attorney will. So, and the population, for lack of, you know, it's always people that don't have the resources to fight the state. So when I started off going on 12 years now, they used to tell me like, oh, John, by the time you do this in 2-3 years, you stop giving a shit. Like, because I'll set all the cases to trial. Because that's the only way you can get decent deal. And I've had cases that haunt me. And so, you know, I find myself working on a position on marijuana case, a position on, you know, simple assault case. I find myself spending tons of time to try. So I just kind of get tired of it. It's not like I'm not going to say I'm not tired of it. I'm not tired, but
it just takes a disproportionate amount of time.
Yes. Takes, and then, and also too, maybe, I think what gets to me is, you know, especially when you're representing indigent clients. You know, I have been practicing for 12 years and my private clients, I've never had any single complaint filed against me. But my indigent clients file complaint with the state bar, like, you know, one out of every 20. I mean, it's never been sustained, but
right.
It just gets to you, you know, like, you know what?
Well,
I'm just going to
move away
from it. I'm trying to save your ass. Why are you doing
it? Well, I apologize for interrupting. I don't remember how much. Yeah, I guess you did graduate a year before me in law school. So I did for criminal. I mean, criminal was my focus as well, and family. And I was able to do, you've learned this yesterday, Duncan, cooperative education. And so I was a public defender for the state in Alaska and worked for the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office. So, I mean, just the complete, you know, both sides of it. And the truth is, in a certain way, and this is not a reflection of you, those people are right, because you don't have the resources to represent them properly, because the resources don't exist. You know what I'm saying? Like, the system is already so broken when they're brought into it, being indigent, already being underrepresented, you having to give in so many resources that aren't even possible, you know, it just, oh, yes, I hear you.
I'll give you an example. I have a case, a client, this case started off in 2018. She was charged with a stage A felony. You know, she was stealing from Alta, the beauty warehouse. And then over time, she ended up picking up three cases in from 2018 to, you know, to 2020. They appointed me on all the cases. And I've worked tons of hours on this case. We were set to go to trial, you know, 3 weeks ago. The state finally makes her an offer that was too good to, you know, too good for her to say no. And she accepts it, right? And I look at my hours that I put in these three cases over the, you know, almost 3 year period. And I have put in over 141 hours, right? In this case, we've done pre-trial, I've done some investigative work, you know, like, and then prepared for trial, did everything. And then I submitted my pay stub, and the judge cut it 100 of what I submitted. And, you know, and of course, like, I'm fighting her just because I don't care anymore, right? Because before, you're like, you know what? I don't want her to blacklist me. But I'm like, no, you got to pay me, you know? So that is one of the, I mean, it's a long way to get to your simple question, but it is the what the system. I mean, some attorneys, I can. And I did not, you know, maybe like I'd be wanting to do criminal practice. I didn't go into law school to do that. You know, it's something that I acquired while I was an autist, and because of the environment, because of people around me, and because of me working, doing the prisoners' rights clinic.
Same.
You did that, right?
Yeah. I did. And listen, so, to John, I want to, check in with you about all of that, because I came in planning to do family, but mostly domestic violence stuff. That's what that's why I went to Northeastern.
Oh, you did the domestic violence clinic?
I didn't end up doing it. Like, I'm just saying that was my plan. That's what my essays were about. That's what I thought I wanted to do.
Oh, okay.
And then when I got there, I was like, criminal all the way. I don't know why. It criminal and family spoke to me. Because to me, it was the most about people, like helping people, good people, working with the people. And although obviously domestic violence is within criminal, mm-hmm. It was too close for comfort. I learned working in the women's rights movement, working in just certain issues, when they're too close to home, I was not objective. I was not as good as I could have been. And it's better for me to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. Yes, I definitely know what you mean. I mean, unlike you, for me, I read hard sciences in undergrad. I read computer science and math with a minor in biology. So I went to undergrad, wanted to...
Wait, I'm sorry. I didn't understand what you said. Can you say that again?
I said computer science with minors.
So computer science.
Computer science and mathematics with minor in biology. So that was my undergrad. So had a pretty good job.
Where were you for undergrad?
I went to Salem. Salem in Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. Salem State.
Yeah, Salem State. That's where
the witches are.
Yeah, that's where. That's right.
I think Duncan knows witches.
Oh,
quite a few witches.
My hometown where I grew up, Meridian, Mississippi, was the burial site of a gypsy queen. So that was cool.
Ooh.
Ooh. Interesting.
To your point on criminal law, like it seems to me like it's the sexiest and the flashiest of the laws, especially like against things like copyright law or tax law, you know.
Oh God, tax law. Oh God.
It's quite interesting. I mean, you deal with people, so it's honestly, if I have money, if I tell my wife every day, like if I win the lottery, I would just do criminal law. You know, it's so engaging and you're really dealing with people's life and, you know, just being a voice and especially in a state like Texas, you know, and in the South here, it's really, you know, the need cannot be overstated. It's such. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean,
everywhere.
You know, you just have to, I mean, I used to just come home every night and just drink because I don't want to. My wife says she doesn't want to hear it, you know, but it's so sad. But.
John, you and I can start a support group and our spouses can start a support group because I know for a fact you are telling so many people's story. I mean, literally the lawyer's story, but then also obviously you and me being from lucky enough and, you know, provided enough for that we can get this education and, you know, focus on these things. But it is just the impact, like there's no one not impacted by how underfunded. And I went from the public defender in Alaska. And when I interviewed with the U.S. attorney, they'd never taken a co-op before. It was unfunded. And the guy's like, I don't know. I don't really, like, I'm really busy. Like, you know, that is an intense office. I literally worked on Madoff. I worked on like huge drug busts. Like Manhattan is cuckoo when it comes. I was narcotics. So like, it was interesting. Madoff was just a side thing they had me do. Anyway. And he's like, why do you want to do this? Like, I don't know if I can give you oversight. You just came from public defender and you said you loved it. And I said, yes, I'm scared that I hate prosecutors. And I want to be wrong. I want to know that prosecutors are really great. And it's just a really messed up system that we're all good lawyers trying to work in. And he was like, you've got the job. And maybe I didn't do a great job because they closed the one after that, right? they didn't do it beyond that. And honestly, like he barely saw me. I made friends with other lawyers and worked for other people. Whatever. I like just, you know, whatever. But I learned. He said this beforehand, and then I saw it was a prosecutor can actually help a defendant more than the defense counsel can. A good prosecutor can look at something, and this was one of his he did
that. That is the key point there. A good prosecutor.
Right. And that's why I get so mad when, you know, Kamala was named the VP candidate. Everyone's like, well, I was like, listen, you want a good lawyer working for the prosecution. Notice I didn't say a conservative lawyer, blah, blah. No, you just want a good, smart person. And this was the example that I said to him that this made me understand this dude's character. This guy had abused his drug parole, whatever. He used drugs, right? And he's sitting there looking at it. And of course, like, just to let you know, Duncan, like prosecutors generally get just like a range. Like, unless you want to go before a judge or talk to your boss, you can give somebody this much to this much, kind of, you know, but you think about mitigating circumstances, blah, blah, blah. And he looked and he's like, I'm going to give the guy another chance to stay out. And I was like, why? And he's like, he wasn't in trouble for dealing. He got in trouble for using. This is not someone who is trying to be a criminal. This is someone with a disease. So. Yeah. I'm going to make it, you can get out, but you're going straight to rehab. Like, you know, because not just like, it's not, and that's the thing I did not realize until I worked in prosecution. He's like, you're looking at someone like that. If he's high and, you know, drives his car and hits it, like you have to understand, I'm thinking about the public writ large, right? So this guy needs to be under protected from himself and his disease, but he doesn't need to go to jail. How the heck is that going to help anybody?
Oh, and it's like, not going to help his addiction.
Right. But we can't just let him wander around because he's dangerous, right? And he puts a danger to himself. And so he's like, you know, he can get out, none of their problems, but he's got to go to rehab like that or whatever. Alcoholics and all, I don't remember the details, but I like that changed my perspective of like, I actually, except for the 20% of lawyers who are horrible, terrible, gross people, I have so much respect for anyone working in criminal law because it's wicked hard on either side.
I mean, you're playing with people's lives. Not easy. Now, changing the subject slightly, still law. So on immigration law, I want to hear more about that and how you got into that. But I also want to ask off the bat, like, are you dealing with Hispanic immigrants or are you dealing with immigrants from other countries more?
About 95% of my clients in the immigration case come from south of the border. So Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, right. You know, just south of the border. That's where they all come from. How do I get into that? You can tell I was born in Nigeria. So I came to the United States when I was 16. And when I was in law school, this is a little known fact about me. And most people don't know. Some people in law school knew because they happened to be at the federal courthouse. I have to sue the United States government to obtain my citizenship. Okay. I filed for my citizenship. This is before I started law school.
I did not know this.
So some people, I believe, Josh, you remember Josh? I think he was a city council in Boston at one point. Josh Zakim, you know him, right? He was a city council somewhere in Boston. So, I mean, he was interning for the judge. So, but I'll give you a little bit of background so how I get to have to sue them. When I was in undergrad, I met this guy. I was born in Nigeria, so I was a first year. So he was a senior, and then he moved to Oregon. And then one day he called me. I'm like, hey, John, there's a package I'm expecting. Can you receive that to me? I'm like, sure, you know. And so he was like, can I send it to you? I'm outside the country. He was in London at that time. I'm like, can you send it to me? And I'll send you, I'll wire you money, right? I didn't know he was sending me something illegal, right? Oh. But so that is how I get involved with Secret Service. So, and I am I don't know how to explain, but I keep receipts of everything. I don't know how that started in my life. I still do. I try not to do it anymore because I'm aware of it. So I try not to do it. So he sends me this, you know, I keep receipts, right, of everything. Yeah, so if I buy anything.
What you said, now that I'm wealthy? Is that what you said?
No, now that I'm aware. I'm very, you know, aware of it. So I try not to do it.
I thought you were like, now that I'm rich, I don't
know. I like to be rich. I'm not rich yet. Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So I remember that day because actually I was supposed to go to Texas. So the package came and he called me right away and then wired me money from, I believe, Western Union. I took the package, you know, there's a parking slip. I didn't even know what I was mailing. I took the parking slip, just threw it in my receipt box, went, received the money, sent it to London. That was it. Went on my way. One day, about 2 months later, middle of the night, knock on my door in Lynn. I was living in Lynn, Massachusetts. I was going to Salem State. Bam, bam, bam. And like, what the hell? Yeah. Yes, we. So it was like Secret Service. And I'm looking at them like, huh? You know? And then they were like, hey, where were you on this day? And I just went to my calendar, right? And I write everything down, right? So I like, oh, I went to Texas. I was in Texas. They were like, okay, did you receive a package? I said, yes, I did. I pulled my distance and I said, yeah. Who sent it to you? I told him. His name is Ajay, you know? And I said, yeah, he sent it to me. And so what did you do? And I told him, you know, I wasn't lying. I just told him, hey, he called me, send this to me.
Yeah.
And then I mailed it. And they were like, why did you keep this? I was like, I just kept it. So they believed me. This was around 12 midnight, right? They were like, okay, you know, next time he sends you something, call me. You know, he leaves his card. His name is William. I still have the card somewhere in my life. His name is William. I kept the card. 4 months later, he calls me again saying, hey, I have another package. Can you pick it up for me?
Mm.
And I was like, I said, sure. Then I turned to my girlfriend. I was living with my girlfriend. We were living in the studio apartment. I'll say, what do you think? She's like, you better call Mr. Williams. I said, okay. Called him. He picked up in one. He was like, okay, sure. We'll be around. They were already tracking it, whatever I was receiving anyway. So that day he came, I called him. He came, they picked me up. We went to get the money that he sent me. They helped me, took me to FedEx. I mailed it to, I don't even remember which country we mailed it to this time around. That was it, you know, boom. And then gone. If he sends it again, call. So I had this interaction. It happened 3 times, right? So when I apply for my citizenship, right, when they do a background, which they're supposed to do, right, FBI is supposed to do, they're getting a hit you know, in Secret Service that there is something, but they don't know what it is. Yeah. This is when, you know, so they can tell. So I apply for
Secret Service. So the assumption is you were kicking puppies.
Exactly. Whatever it was, I don't, you know.
Drinking the blood of children. I don't know.
Yeah. To this day, I still have no idea what I was, you know, I never knew what it, because I'm still trying to figure out, like, why Secret Service, right? I'm starting to look at all the crimes that Secret Service has to deal with, right? You know, counterfeit product, because I've researched it, trying to figure out why Secret Service. So anyway, that's what happened. So I applied for citizenship in 2001. It was waiting. Then I went to law school. When I was in law school, I said, recession. I'm like, no, I can file a lawsuit. Found a lawyer in Boston, and I explained this thing, right? This story sounds so crazy, right? It's, you know, it's, so I explained this thing to the lawyer, and I gave him the card for the Secret Service guy. And before I got home, he called me. My lawyer was Mr. Romanowski, Gregory Romanowski. You know, it's from a Russian guy.
I was going to say, a good Ruski.
Yeah. So he called me. He was like, John, when you left my office, I thought it was the biggest bull crap I've ever heard. But I called the guy. He picked up in one ring and said that what John did, they should have given him citizenship, not the other way around. So that's how we moved on. We have to file a lawsuit.
Wow.
Yeah. So because he didn't believe me, right? Because I didn't have any. I was just telling this story, right? That sounds so crazy. You
that's
know?
The thing. When you're dealing with crazy,
yeah.
It makes you sound crazy.
Yeah. So find a lawsuit, you know, went to trial.
And also, John, I don't want to be rude, but I'm going to point out the fact that you are not white. So that also probably was.
I'm not white. And I'm Nigerian too, you know, so hey.
I was going to say, you're offending all kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Oh, boy.
So the day before trial, the attorney said, hey, they called and said, hey, we can go this evening and get you sworn in at the immigration office in Boston. But if we do that, you cannot sue them under the EA. I think it's EAJA Act, you know, where if you're worth less than $2 million and you have to force the government to, you know, give you something that you're entitled to, you can sue them and recover your attorney fees. He only charged me $2,000, but he said I really had a cost. You know, he believed that we'll win. You know, so we went to trial. We tried the case. I was sworn in Boston District Court. You know, I was sworn in that day. That day, Judge and some Northeastern law student that were doing co-op. That time they were in the courtroom.
Wait, what year?
I was sworn in. I became a U.S. citizen 2007, September 27.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then we sued them. If you look up the case, you know, we sued them after that, you know, sued them.
Send me all the citations, please. I definitely want to look to it because I think this is a story that everybody needs to hear. I mean, the thing I will say, Duncan, just like writ large basic with my experience and everyone's experience with anything related to immigration, like it is so broken. It is truly not serving anyone. Like it's not even like, I want to help people. I'm racist. Like, it's not even that. Like everyone is miserable. Like it's it's not just broken. It is I don't even know how to explain it, but it's I think, John, you tell me your opinion, by far the most annoying areas of law because you're spending so much time doing so many stupid things and everybody else thinks what you're doing is stupid too. that's my take on it.
It takes a lot.
Tedious. That's the word I was looking for.
But tedious, that's constitutional law.
I say con law is more, I mean, I said, John, I would love to hear your take on this. As a white, you know, white privileged woman, when we took con law, I was like, can we just rename it the South is really racist? Like, and I've since updated that statement to America is really racist, but it just kind of truly, and again, like, I'm not someone who wants to read a million cases. That would, like, I went to law school for the ability to help people, but I am not scholarly in an academic, like, traditional sense. And that law was so ridiculous because I was like, yeah, we got it. Treat people well. Oh, we had to have more lawsuits because you were treating these people like crap. Oh, now we have to have these lawsuits because you were treating these people like crap. Like, this is dumb. This is a waste of time. We are just repeating and repeating and not doing what we say we're supposed to be doing.
We wrote rules just to break them. So back on the immigration. So you got your citizenship and you've gone to law school, and you said, I kind of got the sense that you transitioned from criminal law into immigration. And what was the third you said?
Family law.
Family law.
Yeah, transition into immigration. Just, I mean, if you're in Texas anywhere, you know, the people, if you're doing criminal law, about, you know, 90% of your clients or the defendants are brown, you know, and majority, you know, are either black or Mexicans. So, and most of the Mexicans, well, it's Mexican, yeah. So most of the Mexicans, about half or more than half of them are illegals. So everything, you know, the criminal law, there's an impact, you know, there's an immigration consequence of, so you do it over time, you get, because you have to, everything you're doing, you have to really be paying attention that it does not adversely affect them, you know, so the plea cannot affect them because, and also too, you have, most of them have lived here since they came here as young, 2 years old, you know.
Wouldn't it make sense if the people supposedly enforcing or prosecuting whatever word worked with one another too? Like, jeez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty sad. But I mean, immigration law is actually more depressing. Well, in Texas compared to criminal law, it takes a lot. I mean, I've known people that have turned to alcoholic, you know, because it's too much.
It's so awful. Yeah. And I mean, the thing is it's so overwhelmingly overlapped. You almost at this moment, there's so much about, you know, straight up racism in America, all of that. But when it comes to, you know, mostly people from south of the border, like, the desperation for what, like, inhumane treatment they're putting up with, like, it just pushes crazy things to happen. It just, in any situation. Right? Desperation leads to desperation, leads to just ungodly things. And there were things, I'll just say this. When I went to the Southern District, I was like, you know, I, for 100 million reasons, believe marijuana needs to be legal. And that is a whole conversation for another time. And I went in very brazenly, like, you know, drugs are a victimless crime, you know? And then a couple of DEA agents told me stories that I will not repeat, just because there's no need. And they were like, don't tell me no one is victimized by it, right? Like, it's an unintended consequence of people being desperate and of desperation leading to just inhumane behavior. And you see it in all over the world where there is desperation. And it's so close. Even the idea of the border is just so crazy. When you live in Texas, when you live in Arizona, when you live in New Mexico, you're like, what are you talking about? That is just a made up friggin' line somebody pissed on once.
Well, I've actually heard some like crazy stories, and I want to see if John's experienced anything like this, of where there'll be a lot of times where these immigrants aren't even in the courtroom. I mean, pre-COVID, they were like teleconferenced in and may not even understand English or have a translator. And they're just like, nope, we're just pushing forward with the trial.
That is normal. That is everyday. I mean, it was happening. It doesn't have nothing to do with COVID. It's still happening.
No, it's all the time. Always, Duncan, at least one time a day. And I bet John will say I'm underestimating, at least one time a day in America, a child of single digits, meaning they are 9 years old or younger, that does not speak English, is taken into a courtroom and questioned. Who in that room? Or video conference. Even worse, right? So literally, a judge is saying to a four-year-old, Duncan, you have children, so does John, so do I. A four-year-old, why should you come to America? And the kid is like,
okay.
Not even. Mm-hmm. Like, where the fuck is my mom? What are you doing? Like, and this was the point I made last night. And I really just think it's like, we have to, almost in honor of sort of the whole Chauvin like closing argument of like, we have to see what we see in front of our eyes, right? Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. I get it. People are racist. But okay, everyone knows what a four-year-old should be doing most of the time. Or let's say six-year-old. They should be in school, right? So even if this kid has some court proceedings, they should have absolutely nothing to do with it because they should be in school. Even if their parents are horrible criminals and blah, 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 and everybody's horrible, that kid should be in school. Go put them in school or put them somewhere safe where they can play and learn and la, la, la. And then the adults figure out what to do. And I don't even mean it just because like I, you know, can't, it breaks my heart. I mean it like that judge is humiliated. That judge doesn't want to do that.
It's like John said, everybody's miserable in the process.
Everybody is like, God dang it. And it's a waste of money.
But at the same time, like, kudos to you, John, for really pushing into that and
seriously
being the person there to fight for them despite all this mountain of bullshit that goes along with it and against them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not enough, but it's getting better. I mean, just changing government, you know, in a while in the presidency has really, you know, took us out. I mean, the past.
Excuse me, can you just be a little more articulate? Because, like, I am beyond a fan of Joe Biden. Person, family friend, yeah. La, la, la. Change administration means what? What has he mm-hmm. done? What has he done? What is he undone, I guess?
well, I mean...
Not much yet.
Welcome to Worcester. $1.25, please.
Put the tea on. I have stories.
Of all the stories that I'd like to tell you, in the course of doing this podcast and other things, the story of Mac and me is my favorite story of my life. Mac is a murderer. He made a big mistake as a 17-year-old kid at the height of crack in 1987 in Boston. He has served his time for that, and he served it well. Much more information about all of that to come. But since the beginning of the aughts, Mac has been in jail for something he did not do. 11 years ago, I had the pleasure of representing Mac as a student attorney when I was in law school before the parole board. I did a damn good job, if I do say so myself, but despite my best efforts, Mac was not granted parole and has not been granted parole for the subsequent 11 years. So this is the first time that I've actually recorded Mac and talk about our friendship, which since the time that I stopped representing him many, many years ago, our relationship has been all friendship. So I want to say a few things up at the top. First of all, a lot of the audio you're going to hear is bad quality, especially when you hear from Mac, because he's in an echoing large prison room and I'm recording on a phone. So it will sound garbled at times and, you know, just not be good quality, on top of which the absolute most important thing to me is that nothing I do hurts Mac and that everything I do helps Mac. So there may be parts of our audio that I've cut out, or that you hear me talking more, or you miss something that he said. That is for reasons that have nothing to do with how I'm presenting it. It's just really important for me to explain that I am no longer representing Mac as his attorney. I am his friend. Secondly, I'm putting our story out here, not as a journalist who's investigating him. This is the story of my friendship with Mac. There is so much more to this story to be told, but I'm not going to tell it right now for one main reason. Mac is not out of jail yet. I cannot fully tell our story and his story without him present and in no way be hurting the chances of him getting out, because that is what's most important to me. This story has a ton of twists and turns that I will share with as soon as I can. Will Mac get out of jail?
So without further ado, here is Mac, in his own words, explaining why he has been rehabilitated enough to re-enter society.
Behind the wall. If possible today, I'd like to close this gap between this parole board and myself in hopes of resolving these preconceived concerns that this board may have in order to be able to move on to the next chapter of my life under supervised release, where I can continue my work in community building, self-atoning, and serving as a cautionary warning against street life to our youth. For I've broke the cycle of violence in myself, and I've done through mentorship of others in prison. In the interest of resolving any concerns, I've submitted an extensive social bio to explain my trajectory in the Department of Correction as a youth to the man sitting before you today. My goal is to share with you those thinking processes that led me to habilitate myself first, then rehabilitate myself from there. Also to show this parole board when I developed those tools that informed my work upon my release in 2006 and continue work today. All of which has resulted in institutional violence for the last 22 years on my record.
This is all true.
Since 2008, I have organized and hosted culture and religious events at every prison in a deeply sincere effort to promote reunification, redemptive opportunities, and to encourage others to find themselves, while working to organize and educate my Black and Latino community through programs like Spanish United and African Heritage Coalition. But more importantly, how I navigated this sense of responsibility between myself and administrators, which demonstrates I use all available sanctioned processes to address concerns or air grievances. I do not know who shot Mr. Twitty and injured Mr. Jones. Had I done so, I'd have accepted responsibility for his death and provided Mr. Twitty's families their closure back when I was offered favorable terms to plead in his case. As I've always asserted, I'm completely empathetic to the Tweed's family's loss of their son and brother. I can't personally imagine how I'd cope with the loss of my own son if his life was cut short through violent means. Nonetheless, I completely recognize that someone like myself that was involved in and promoted street life made it possible for Mr. Twitty and others' death to occur around the city of Boston at that time. For that, I am deeply sorry for. It is not my goal today to convince the parole board of my innocence.
Mac for president.
My goal is to precisely resolve those expressed concerns by this board surrounding my innocent assertion. As it relates to Mr. Hughes, I can't speak for what's in his mind. I can say Mr. Hughes has never made this claim of our participation at any other judicial forum, nor issued a police statement to this effect prior to appearing before this parole board. I can also say earnestly, as an incarcerated person, that it's common knowledge among prisoners that a parole candidate increases his chances for parole by adopting all the Commonwealth's theory, even in cases that the parole candidate knows aren't true. My belief is Hughes felt similarly that he could not only acknowledge his own guilt without also acknowledging mine, because it would possibly appear as if he was a certain criminal loyalty and thus was not being forthright. The same detectives responsible for inducing a false identification against Mr. Willie Bennett in the now 1989 infamous Charles Stewart case were the same detectives involved in the inducement of a series of false or questionable identifications against myself. This was done by employing questionable investigative techniques that include coercing, threatening, promising rewards, which was used to exploit vulnerable people or otherwise those with motive to lie. Okay. Two separate reviews were done by the U.S. and Attorney General's office, who found these investigative tools improper.
I found that
Mr. Andre's ID is a byproduct of this process. Photos. Ultimately, it was my poor lifestyle choices that placed me on the detective's radar in the first place.
And the color of his skin.
If it wasn't for this unlawful conviction, I'd have been dead a long time ago. It gave me the opportunity to grow into self-love and to find my purpose. With that said, I also believe that the last 3 years has further demonstrated that I no longer think or function as a criminal, nor as an inmate, but as a citizen who exercises citizenship in prison and continues to manage a busy schedule between my avocation that recently led to the reinstatement of the African Heritage Coalition program at Concord, being an Emerson student, maintaining employment, conducting special events and attendance in those programs that strengthen me as a person like restorative justice. All the things that the parole board would expect of me as a parolee, I do now. It also demonstrates my sustained emotional growth, in which is attested to not just by my deeds, but also in a growing chorus of community supporters, family, and loved ones. And therefore, I ask for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Council.
Fucking
no. Good afternoon. And first, let me say.
Thanks to everyone who contributed to this episode of Sex, Politics, and Bacon. For more information on John Nwosu's work, please visit johnnwosu.com. That's johnnwosu.com. Join us next time for the second half of our chat with John Nwosu. It was just too good for only one episode. And until then, take care of you. And please subscribe to Sex, Politics, and Bacon. Can you say bye-bye?
Bye-bye. See you next time.